We're doing a quick overview of the halachic process, how halacha evolved and continues to evolve. When Moshe went up to Sinai, so God gave him a Torah. God told us how he wants us to run our lives. Now, Torah consists of the written law, the 613 mitzvahs that we find in the Torah. But Torah, by the same token, consists of the oral law, a tradition which we have that interprets for us what's written in the Torah and also gives us other requirements, other responsibilities that aren't explicitly stated in the Torah. Let's take an example. Torah says you're supposed to wear totafot. What are totafot? So we say totafot are tefillin, phylacteries. But you read it in the Torah. Torah gives you this word that isn't even a Hebrew word. The Gemara says it's a word that comes from African languages. That the Torah put together to indicate how many compartments tefillin have to have. That goes to the oral law. Do tefillin have to be black or white or gray or silver or gold? It doesn't say. We have a tradition. It has to be black. That the straps have to be black. That it has to be made a certain way. We have tradition. That's something that we have going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. You look in the Torah, you can't figure out what tefillin are supposed to look like. You look in the Torah, you can't figure out what Shabbos is supposed to look like. Simple reading of the Torah seems to indicate, come Shabbos, sit down and don't move. The Torah says, Al yetze ish mi mikomo. No person should leave their place on Shabbos. You think, you come Shabbos, sit in one place and don't leave. So we have an oral tradition that explains to us that on the one hand, the Torah wasn't so stringent. The Torah meant you could leave your home, you could go around, you're supposed to be with friends, you're supposed to enjoy the Shabbat. At the same time, we have part of that oral tradition that teaches us 49 other actions, which doesn't clearly state in the Torah, but we derive based on our oral tradition that those actions are prohibited on Shabbos. So our oral law is really what defines the way we keep Judaism. If we try to open up a book of the Torah and figure out what it says without the oral law, we'd be lost. Judaism, if a person didn't know anything but to read Hebrew and he opened the Sefer Torah, then the Judaism he'd be living by would be totally different than the Judaism we have. Even the Karaites, who claim to go based on just the written law without the oral tradition, if you look closely, you'll see that's not so. They never did, nor do they do today. If they started with a blank Torah using their own intellect, they wouldn't have everything they have today. A lot of it, they're copying us. And some of the things they say, we go without any tradition, the way we understand the Torah. Okay. Every generation had its people that didn't like to accept the tradition of how to keep the Torah. Starting with last week's parasha, Korach. Korach stepped forward and said, who said that God really wants to keep the Torah this way? And ever since then, since Moshe Rabbeinu's time, every generation had its heretics. One generation was Korach, and one generation was the Karaites, and one generation was the Sadducees, and one generation was the Reformed. Every generation had its people who said, we don't want to accept the oral tradition. Okay, it's nothing new. It's a mistake that many people make. It's a mistake that's understandable because part of the oral tradition is that God says, I am going to give you laws of inference, and I'm going to give you a very intricate oral law which one must spend a lot of time studying before one can master. And one must spend even more time studying the laws of inference in order to know how to apply them. We have the fortiori, the Kal Vachomer, that says if on a more lenient situation, the Torah says we have to be stringent. So certainly in a more stringent situation, we would have to be stringent. For example, if we'll take an example that's not exactly accurate because it's not all biblical, but we'll take a simple example. If one knows that one is forbidden to have yichud, to be alone in the room with a girl that he might potentially marry, so then one can derive from that certainly one is forbidden to be alone in the room, meaning a place where there's yichud, with a woman that he's forbidden to marry, a married woman or someone else that he's forbidden to marry. So we see that that's a simple example of a Kal Vachomer. There are other laws of inference. So when the Torah uses a certain term and the Torah explains to me what that term means, so then I can infer from that that in other instances where the Torah will use that term, I can apply the same definition that was applied the first time or another time that Torah defined that term. Now you can understand that could get very sticky, because the Torah doesn't come and say, pause. Here's a definition. From here on in, use this definition. But rather, the Torah gives me a series of laws, and in passing, the Torah defines certain terms. And sometimes there seems to be contradictions between how the Torah is defining a term. And we have other laws of inference. Sometimes the Torah says this law is like that law. Or sometimes we say the fact that the Torah said two laws within the same sentence came to teach me that there's a common denominator between them. That's called a hekesh. So we have different laws of inference, and the application of these laws of inference can uproot the whole Torah. If you use these laws of inference incorrectly, then you can infer things that are totally contradictory to the Torah. So in order to know how to apply these laws of inference, one must study many, many years by a teacher and get the tradition as to how to apply them. When Moshe Rabbeinu was taught these laws of inference, so God showed him how you could use the laws of inference. You take a certain new question that will arise, and God told him, okay, now apply the laws of inference. And God showed him 49 ways using the laws of inference to prove that the conclusion to a certain question would be that it is permissible. And then God said, now look at this. And God showed him 49 ways using the laws of inference to prove that in that same case the ruling should be that it's forbidden. So Moshe said, well, God, if the laws of inference can prove both ways, so how am I ever going to figure out what the right answer is? If I could use logic to arrive at two contradictory conclusions, how do I know which is the correct conclusion? So God told him, you have to learn the Torah as best as you can and purify yourself from all partiality. And teach other rabbis, and they'll all purify themselves from partiality. Now, to attain a level where we're impartial is very difficult. Most of us enter even conversations that should be logical with preconceived notions. There was research done recently where they took people, sat them down, attached electrodes to their heads, and measured what part of the brain reacts when we're bothered emotionally, and what part of the brain reacts when we're challenged intellectually. And then they took these people, and they took a given, something that they took for granted logically, and they presented them with facts that contradict what they thought was so. And they saw that the most activity was found in the part of the brain that was emotional. Meaning when we're presented with facts that contradict something that we logically think is so, the first thing we do is react emotionally. We don't react intelligently. Now, in order for a person to be a rabbi who can express an opinion in the understanding of the Torah, one has to have not only studied the laws of inference for many years, but one also has to work on purifying oneself, of purging all partiality. One has to approach it with a purity of thought, a purity of intellect, and then say, okay, now what is the Torah teaching me? Not what do I think? And that's why we'll often find in the Gemara that Amoraim will bring proofs to one another. One Amora will say, my opinion is X. And the other Amora will say, my opinion is Y. And then they start arguing, and then suddenly the one who said, my opinion is X, says, but I have a proof that Mr. Y is correct. Because they weren't debating for the sake of winning the debate. They were debating for the sake of attaining the truth. Now, that's a very high level. So God told Moshe, once you attain, you're on that level, and you teach other rabbis and they'll be on that level, then those rabbis can express an opinion. And then I implanted within different people different forms of logic. And what seems most logical to me may not seem most logical to you. And after we spend time talking to one another, ascertaining that we understand one another, and you understand my logic and I understand your logic, and even though we've purged ourselves of any partiality, at the end of the day there is that human factor which causes that different people will arrive at different conclusions. And God says the Torah is a living Torah, and the Torah has to evolve based upon the logic of the rabbis of that generation. So the rabbis, God told Moshe, the rabbis will sit together and study and analyze and discuss and present one another with proofs why one way is more correct than the other. And at the end of the day, they won't convince one another that they're right, because there is legitimacy to both understandings. There's legitimacy to 49 understandings in each direction. And God said, that's why you need a court, and the court goes by the majority opinion, and that's how I want the Torah to evolve. Now, we just went through a simple process that God says, this is how, using the laws of inference, the laws of logic, we are to arrive at conclusions, what the laws of the Torah would say in new instances that aren't explicitly stated in the Torah. But let's take a step back. When you and I when we read the Torah, so we're no dummies. We can also understand what the Torah is saying. And we could also apply our logic. And it's very difficult for us to recognize that our logic is tainted. We feel like what we're saying is 100% logical. And I think this is the source of difficulty that people have had throughout the generations in accepting the oral law. Because the oral law is saying, this is the logical conclusion based upon these laws of logic, and the oral law lays it before us, that this is why we've reached these conclusions. Now, when people listen to this, so it takes a certain level, give me one second, it takes a certain level of respect, of admiration for the rabbis in order to accept that what they're saying is worth more than what I'm saying. Because after I've learned for a year or two, I start feeling like I have an opinion as well. And it takes another many years of learning before we can value the genius that's behind the Talmud, the genius that's behind the conclusions the rabbis arrived at. And many people don't spend those years studying. They just open up Gemara, they start learning, and then they have questions. And then they say, wait a second, who said they're smarter than I am? And a person doesn't realize the distance between him and them. So a person can easily say, well, fine, they said this way, I say that way. It's not difficult to make that error. And that's why I think throughout generations people have made that error. The Maharal explains it on a nicer note. He says that God made the Torah in a way that every Jew feels like he has a part in the Torah. Everyone, when they read the Torah, they feel connected. And when a rabbi comes and tells you, this is the tradition and this is the law, a person feels like, why are you defining the Torah for me? It's my Torah as well. God made it that we all feel connected to the Torah. And that's a positive thing, that we all feel connected. But that connection can sometimes be an obstruction to the acceptance of the rabbi's definition of the Torah, because we feel so connected. So he presents it in a nicer light. Yeah?
But isn't the oral law, wasn't that also given by Hashem? Or is that derived from logic by the rabbi?
A lot of the oral law was given by Hashem, but one of the things Hashem gave us was the laws of inference. And God said, now evolve, now grow. Use these laws of inference so that when new questions arise, you'll be able to derive them from the Torah. So Moshe Rabbeinu had the written law and the oral law, and Moshe Rabbeinu had new institutions. The rabbis also have the power to institute new things. When Moshe Rabbeinu got the Torah, it doesn't say in the Torah that on Monday and Thursday we read the Torah in public. Moshe Rabbeinu instituted this. Moshe said the Jewish people shouldn't go 3 days without reading Torah. So he instituted a rabbinic institution with his court that we should read the Torah every Monday and Thursday in public. So the rabbis were given the power to make rabbinic institutions, and the rabbis were also given the responsibility to derive from the Torah what would be the law in new cases that arise. Now, this level of inference, this ability to derive from the Torah, was true for 2,000 years. From the time the Torah was given till the end of the Tanakh period, till the destruction of the Second Temple. Shortly after the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jews suffered widespread persecution. They were exiled. And the level of learning went down. And the students couldn't spend the tens of years studying by their mentors as their predecessors had. And their level of mastery of these laws of inference went down. And one understanding is that it was preordained, that that was part of the godly plan, that we would enter a new phase in Jewish history, the phase of the oral law, as we'll discuss in a second. And one understanding is that it was simply a result of the persecution. The Romans were wiping out the rabbinic academies. There was decree after decree against learning Torah in public. And so we arrived at a generation where Rabbi Yehuda Anasi Rebbe sees that he's got a window, a period of peace in which he could gather the rabbis and write down the summary of the oral law, shorthand version of the Mishnah, and he does that. And he works with them to verify the clearest and most accurate tradition of the oral law, and he writes it down in the Mishnah. And this was an unusual occurrence, because we had a tradition going back to Moshe Rabbeinu, that one may not write down the oral law. The oral law must remain oral. One could never sum it up in words, in written words. and one shouldn't write it down. And Rabbi Yehuda Anasi said, Eis lasos l'shem eiferu Torah secha. There comes a time where we have to do something unusual for the sake of God, otherwise the whole Torah will be undone. And he gave this ruling, and the rabbis, the court in that time, agreed with him, that we, from now on, we write down the Mishnah. We're going to have one version of Mishnah and write it down. Now, the Mishnah is very short. Much of the oral law remains oral. And the logic behind the Mishnah remained oral. A few centuries later, the rabbis saw that this logic was being lost as well. And so the rabbis wrote down the Talmud. Now, the Talmud isn't just a recording of an academy. The Talmud doesn't just record, well, this one said this, and that one said that, this was of the opinion this way, that was of the opinion that way. Even the questions that the Talmud raises and then answers were specifically chosen to be written into the Talmud. And the Talmud really teaches us the logic and the reasoning and the rectification of different Mishnayot. Meaning, sometimes a Mishnah indicates one way, and then you continue and you have a few Mishnahs later, a Mishnah that indicates another way. How do you rectify those two? So the Talmud tells us the conclusions in understanding the reasoning behind the Mishnah, and the Talmud also teaches us the rectification of Mishnayot that contradict one another. That's a very simplified explanation of what the Talmud does. That's one explanation of what we're doing in the Talmud. We have rules. When we learn Talmud, we're supposed to understand from the Talmud what is the halacha, right? We read a Mishnah, we read the Talmud on the Mishnah, we read the Gemara, and now we're supposed to understand what is the halacha. The problem is that the Talmud doesn't usually come to conclusions. The Talmud doesn't say, and now the halacha is X. It's exceptional when the Talmud does that. Most of the time, the Talmud just brings, this one says the opinion this way, this one says the opinion that way, and then they argue back and forth. And sometimes you can understand that one proves his point, and sometimes you don't understand. Sometimes it's only in a later tractate that the Talmud is going to refer to this disagreement and take for granted that one side was correct. So you have to remember that disagreement and notice, take note that in the Talmud's discussion, the Talmud is taking for granted one side's opinion. Sometimes you could miss it. So it's complicated to understand what was the conclusion of the Talmud on any given question. And so, following the Talmud, the Rishonim wrote short works trying to just take out what are the conclusions. So we have Baal Halachos Gedolos, Rav Yehudai Gaon, who compiled a work called the Halachos Gedolos, the Great Halachos, in which he basically quotes the text of the Gemara with conclusions. And he shows the conclusions at each point. And we have the Rib, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, who did a similar work, also quoting from the Gemara and quoting conclusions. Being that it isn't always clear what the conclusion of the Gemara was, being that it isn't always clear what the Talmud felt the halachic conclusion should be, so that leaves room for disagreement. And different rabbis had different traditions and ruled differently. And that's how we have the evolvement of Sfard. The rabbis in Spain had one tradition as to how to understand the arguments in the Talmud and the conclusions in the Talmud. And you had Ashkenaz, the Tosafists, the rabbis out in Ashkenaz, Rashi, and Rashbam, Rabbeinu Tam, the Rosh, the rabbis out in Germany and France, in Ashkenaz, their tradition and their understanding of what the conclusions of the Talmud was. And what we see is an evolvement of at least two distinct customs within Judaism that stem from different understandings and different traditions as to how to understand the Talmud's conclusion. Now, again, that's an oversimplification. There are more than two. There's the Rambam, Maimonides. But the Rambam is very much in line with Sfard, because the Rambam is a disciple of the Rimi Gash, who was a disciple of the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. So the Rambam and the Rif go hand in hand most of the time. They usually have the same conclusion. Then we reach the Tur, was the Rosh Hashanah and the Shulchan Aruch, where they, again, are trying to summarize. So what's the bottom line? So we've had the Baal Halachos Gedolos. We've had the Rif, we've had the Rosh, we have the Rambam. one after another, and again, we're skipping many, many rabbis, compile works, each one writing what he feels is the bottom line. Now, they don't arrive at the same conclusions. They each have different proofs to arrive at different conclusions. Very often, everyone arrives at the same conclusion. More often than not, we have the same conclusion. But there's still a good 30-40% of the Talmud where they arrive at different conclusions. Maybe 40% is too much, but 30%, that's I think, approximately right. And this is where we have the source of different customs and different rulings in halacha. The Rama went with Ashkenaz. Rav Moshe Isserles, he had a tradition that when we see a view held by the Tosafists and the Rosh, and that view is argued upon by the Rif and the Rambam, so being that the Tosafists and the Rosh came after the Rambam and the Rif, and they had greater numbers, the Tosafists were large academies of rabbis, so we go halacha with them, and that's the Rama's ruling for Ashkenaz. Rav Yosef Karo lived here in Israel, compiled the Shulchan Aruch, the Codex. He said, no, the greatest rabbis in the last few centuries were the Rambam, Rif, and Rosh. And where there's a disagreement between the three, we take the best of three. Now, being that the Rambam and the Rif almost always agree, so the Shulchan Aruch is almost always going to be in line with the custom of Sfard, which is the opinion of the Rambam and the Rif usually. And so we have in the Shulchan Aruch, we have the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. And the Sfardim will go with the Shulchan Aruch, and Ashkenazim will go with the Rama. Because the Rama was rabbi out in Krakow for Ashkenaz. What he wrote was the customs and the halacha for Ashkenazic Jewry. And Shulchan Aruch wrote for Sephardi Jewry. The story doesn't end there because, as our rabbis knew would be the case with the oral law, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't cover everything. Shulchan Aruch covers a lot. It doesn't cover everything. That still leaves room for many, many questions.
Shulchan Aruch was written by
Rav Yosef Karo.
Based on the findings of Rambam and
the Shulchan Aruch basically took the best of three. He took Rambam, Rif, and Rosh, and he said where there's a disagreement between them, we'll take the best of three.
Which
usually ends up being the Rambam and the Rif. The Rambam himself testifies that he disagreed with the Rif in his compilation less than 10 times. That's not true. It's not right to say it's not true. It's not to be understood literally, because the Rambam disagreed with the Rif numerous times, much more than 10 times. So that needs definition, what the Rambam meant, that I only have disagreed with him less than 10 times. I found him to be a complete work, he says. I teach it in my academy, and I've hardly ever disagreed with him, and it numbers less than 10, he writes. So we have to understand what the Rambam meant by that. Because it numbers more than 10, at least on the surface, what we see. They do seem to arrive at different conclusions over 30 times, many times. I haven't counted, but I saw someone else write this number, that he says it's in excess of 30. Okay, that's a different class. It's a different discussion, what the Rambam meant by that. Coming back to our review, so now we've boiled it down to Shulchan Aruch and Rama. But the Shulchan Aruch and Rama are shorthand works. The Shulchan Aruch wrote a much greater work, and that's his exposition on the Tur. Before the Shulchan Aruch came along, there was the Tur, who's the son of the Rush, Rabbi Yaakov, the son of the Rush, and he wanted to write a work on summarizing the laws of every day, the laws of monetary laws, the laws between husband and wife, the laws of rabbi, shechita, kashrus, meat and milk. So he wrote a work breaking it down to these four major topics. And in that work, he tried to summarize the opinions of the great rabbis up to his day. And the Beis Yosef expanded on his work. Rav Yosef Karo wrote a book called the Beis Yosef, and that's really his greatest work. Not the Shulchan Aruch. His greatest work is the Beis Yosef, the work in which he expands on the Tur. And over there, he summarizes the opinions of the Rambam, the Rif, the Rosh, Rashi. And then the Rav Yosef Karo saw that his disciples weren't reviewing his work often enough. So he said, I'll make for them a shorthand work. I'll make for them a short review. And that's the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch was written as a short book that his students could review once a month. His goal was, he writes in his introduction, he says, this is a short work for the students that just boils down what the bottom line, my conclusions were. And this I wrote for the students so that once a month they could review all of the halacha. It's like a kitzur Shulchan Aruch. The reason why we have such huge volumes of Shulchan Aruch is because we have all the commentaries all around the Shulchan Aruch. So now we have the Shulchan Aruch and we have the Rama. They wrote similar works, just coming from different vantage points and coming from two basic differences were what caused the difference in halacha between the Rambam, between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. One was this difference of opinion, how we give halachic ruling. Do we give more weight to the Rambam and Rif, or do we give more weight to the rabbis in Ashkenaz, the Tosafis and the Rash? And the second difference was they came from different parts of the globe, so they had different customs. So in some places, Shulchan Aruch is going to say the custom is that all of the month of Elul, we get up early, we blow shofar, we say slichos, and the Rama is going to say, well, where I come from, they don't do that. They only wake up the week before Rosh Hashanah. The Shulchan Aruch is going to write, the custom is that we don't shave from Rosh Chodesh, from Pesach till Lag BaOmer, in Sfir Somer, and the Rama is going to say, well, where I come from, the custom is from Rosh Chodesh until 3 days into the month of Sivan. Two different customs when we keep the laws of mourning of Sfir Somer. But those things depend on customs, how the customs evolved in different parts of the globe. We mentioned that there was a difference between the period up to the Amoraim and the Amoraim. That until the Amoraim's period, the rabbis had a handle on the laws of inference and were able to derive new questions from the Torah directly. Meaning if a question arose, if we clone an animal, is that new animal kosher or not kosher? It wasn't born from another animal. Do we treat it like a cow? Or do we treat it like grass? Or do we treat it like hay? Do you need to do shechita on it? Is that considered an animal? It wasn't born from an animal. Or is that a new species? Is it kosher? Is it not kosher? Do you need shechita? How do we treat that new animal? So today we have trouble dealing with that question. In the times of the Mishnah, they'd say, wait, we'll analyze it, we'll figure out the answer from the Torah, we'll derive it from the Torah. That was in the time of the Mishnah. We lost that ability 2,000 years ago, almost 2,000 years ago. We're coming close to 2,000 years since the sealing of the Mishnah. We're holding 1,600 years since then. In the time of the Talmud already, they didn't have that power. They already lost that ability. And that's why the Talmud tries to derive where did the Tanoim, where did the rabbis in the Mishnah get what they said from. The rabbis in the Talmud are working backwards. They're saying, we see in the Mishnah that they said this and this, so what's the source for that? So they're working backwards, but they won't give new derivations to new laws. By the same token, we had another step down in the period in the time of the Shulchan Aruch. Until the Shulchan Aruch came along, the rabbis had such mastery of the Talmud that when a new question would arise, they'd look in the Talmud. And they mastered the Talmud so well, in order to be a rabbi in those days in the times of the Gaonim, you had to be tested on the whole Talmud by heart. That was you wanted the title Gaon. So Gaon is Gematria. Gaon is Gematria 60. There are 60 tractates in the Talmud. You want to get that title, you had to be tested on all 60 tractates by heart. That's step number one. So in those days, the rabbis had a great mastery of the Talmud. And if you asked a question, the rabbi would say either he knew the answer from the Talmud or he'd sit down and derive the answer from the Talmud. When we hit the generation of the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama recognized that the generation had gone down a step. And the rabbis were no longer capable to derive the halacha from the Talmud. And so what they did is they said, let's take the major opinions that preceded us and let's write down the bottom line halacha. And from the time of the Shulchan Aruch till today, we're in the period called Achronim, the period after the Talmud. So we have Rabban Savaroi, Gaonim, and then Rishonim, the first. Rishon is like first. We have the Gaonic period and then the Rishonim. And then, from the Shulchan Aruch on, we've gone down a step to the Achronim, to the period till today. And the main point that we see that changed in the period of the Shulchan Aruch is that the rabbis felt that they had gone down a level. Again, there was great persecution in the world. There were the Crusades. You had communities wiped out. You had a whole generation of rabbis who couldn't study the way their predecessors had. The many of the great academies were destroyed. Those that weren't destroyed, the rabbis were on the run. You had whole communities that didn't have a rabbi. There's a famous story about a few rabbis that were captured on a ship by pirates, and the pirates sold them in different ports. And in doing that, they did a great favor to Jewish history, because these great rabbis were sold to different communities. The communities wanted to redeem them from bondage. They knew Jews were in bondage on this pirate ship, so they paid the money and they redeemed them. And in doing so, they brought great rabbis to different communities throughout the world, communities that didn't have rabbis. And these rabbis coming there ensured that the Jewry would continue the way it should. So it's a historical paradox that we look fondly on the fact that those rabbis were caught by pirates and sold to these different communities, because it was a tremendous favor. The rabbis came to the communities and they saw the present rabbi teaching. In one of the cases, he was teaching a Mishnah in Yuma, and the rabbi got it wrong. That the one who was supposed to be teaching the Mishnah. So he's sitting there in the back and he doesn't want to interrupt. And afterward he says, you know, the Mishnah means like this and like this. And they see that he knows so much more that the rabbi says, hey, I'm stepping down, you're rabbi. And they took positions of leadership, and it was a great blessing to the Jewish people that these rabbis were scattered, that these rabbis caused Torah to flourish again. Each one built an academy wherever he landed. But that there was a marked difference between the rabbis before the end of the 15th century and afterwards. The 15th century was the turning point. The Crusades and the destruction of the great academies caused a situation that the rabbis said, we can no longer argue with our predecessors. Up until the Shulchan Aruch, if a rabbi learned the Talmud and he came to a conclusion that was different than Maimonides, he'd say, my opinion is such and such, and he didn't care to argue with Maimonides. By the time of the Shulchan Aruch, the rabbis recognized they were no longer on that level. They couldn't take on Maimonides. They couldn't take on the Ravid, the Rosh, the Rif, the Baal Halachos Dolos, Rashi, the Rashba, the Ramban. All the great Rishonim were on a level where they could argue with one another. They'd quote him and say, yeah, but I disagree because of such and such a proof. But then during the period of the Shulchan Aruch, the Jewish people went down another level. And that's the period of the Achronim, the period that we are till today, in which, in order to derive halacha, we look back and say, okay, how did they understand the Talmud? How did they understand the conclusions of the Talmud? And using the words of the Rishonim, we derive halacha. We can no longer open up a Talmud and say, well, I've learned the Talmud, I've mastered the Talmud, so it seems to me that the conclusion of the Talmud is such and such. We can't do that. We're not on a level to do that. What we can do is open the Talmud, open the Rishonim, open the Shulchan Aruch. Today we need to take Shulchan Aruch into account also. We can't argue on the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch was accepted throughout the... I mean, unless one is Yemenite, but almost all communities in the world accepted the Shulchan Aruch. So either Shulchan Aruch or Ramah, today we have a lot more to contend with. When we want to derive halacha, we have to know what the source of the halacha is. We have to learn the Talmud. After we've learned the Talmud, we have to learn the Rishonim. After we learn the Rishonim, we can learn the Shulchan Aruch, the Torah, the Beis Yosef Shulchan Aruch. And then we could understand what the Shulchan Aruch meant and know how to apply it. We have to expand on this, but I think we're out of time. What time is it? What? We have a few more minutes? Avit is 10. Ah, so we'll stop here. Maybe next week we'll continue on the evolvement of halacha from the Shulchan Aruch. How halacha can evolve and what do we do today?
Well, and you can upload these things on the website.